Alexander Elyachevsky was born in 1970 in Sumgayit, Azerbaijan. When he was 15, he came to Moscow. He studied theoretical physics and mathematics. Then he stayed in Israel for work and in the United States. Then in 1998, he returned to Russia. Two years before that, in 1996, he published his first poems. Then several essays and novels were published in German. Next to the Persian, there is another book, Matisse, which was published last year. It's part of the tetralogy of four books. Ever since 2013, he's been living in Tel Aviv. One year before, he already published a travel guide for Jerusalem. Obviously, it's the very first case where somebody coming from far away has published a guidebook. And it shows that the country, Israel, the geography, the culture is very important to him. And so he wrote the guidebook before he went there. Andreas Tretner was born in 1959 in Gera. He translates from Russian, Bulgarian, and Czech. And when you ask him, how is that possible to translate from so many languages, he always says, they're so much related. It's a beautiful answer. He has translated Pelevin, Sorokin, and Shishkin, and he was here 5 years ago together with Shishkin as an award winner of the International Literature Prize. So he is a person we get to see more often. He lives in Berlin. The Persian, 650 pages. I cannot tell you all the events that take place, but I have to tell you what it's all about. It's about a travel, a journey of Ilya. Ilya comes from the west of California to the extreme east, back to Azerbaijan, where his roots are. And so it's always a question of a synthesis of East and West. He's a geologist working in the industry. He can hear oil. Are we going to hear the oil today? Do we have an object here where we can hear the oil tonight? I can sing the oil. It's not so difficult, because there is a noise when you hear, when you're at the drilling hole. And in the oil field where the first hole was drilled, there was such a high pressure that even the pipes were resonating. Can you hear me? You hear the translation? Give us an impression of how it sounds when you hear the oil. Can you sing the oil that Ilya hears? I think it's like the sound that whales make. It's a sound of the whale cry. And it can be described as the sound model also for the oil. Many, many years ago, we still didn't use the internet. And in order to make phone calls, we sometimes heard these very rhythmic and primitive sounds, these bleeps. And this is something like the oil that emanates, that gives sounds. Hearing is important in the novel, and seeing is more important, and that is why we have the opportunity to see some wonderful objects. Ilya comes to Azerbaijan because he's looking for his wife, who had left him. And he also comes back there because he wants to reunite with the friend of his childhood, Hashim. He lives in an oil area in a natural reserve near Baku. He works as an ornithologist and defends the birds against the hunting of the rich people, the people from the Emirates. He's also a religious thinker who wants to renew Islam in the name of Sufis and Zoroastria. And he's also a poet, so we are going to see this encounter between a geologist and a poet. It's also a synthesis. Vladimir Khlebnikov is sort of the middleman. He is a futurologist, important for Russian literature. Here we see a picture of him. Here we see him in uniform. This is related to Khlebnikov in Kharkov. There he had to defend against an army, an enemy army. And after this photograph was taken, he was sent to the psychiatric hospital, and he had a wonderful psychiatrist, a person who was interested in the link between all kinds of psychic deviations, and he participated in his creative process. He spent a couple of months there in this psychiatric hospital, and he helped to also disseminate the literature of the Bolsheviks that used to write there and used to hide their literature under their mattress. It is a novel that tells with a lot of identity, has many metaphors, many images, and there's reason for that. Ilya, who we accompany in this book most of the time, is a photographer, and he keeps on taking photographs. Ilya and Hashem, when they were together as children, had even managed to photograph the whole town, the whole city. They had built camera obscuras everywhere. They used all kinds of light slots through which the sun could come in, and they create images behind on the wall. So the city creates an image of itself. Then there are many stories, many characters, many places this novel takes us to. Since it's a trip from the west to the east, and you stop over at many places of Europe, which is described in much detail, and you get to know Baku as a rich city, the power of the oil boom. At the same time, there's no the gold rush in San Francisco. So you have this comparison. You have the Rothschilds, you have Alfred Nobel, and many persons I never heard of, but still, they are explained and described in this novel. And all of that started somewhere. Namely, it started with a friend of yours, Parchikov. One of Parchikov's books is called Oil, and maybe this is the connection to you. It is wonderful for Andreas to bring this anthology, because last time I've seen this book at Alexei Parchikov when he was still alive. Unfortunately, he died in 2009. Alexei Parchikov is my friend in literature and in a way also my teacher. And my ideas about the Persian all started when I met Parchikov. It was in 1998. I wrote my first prose book. It was a short a novel called Oil. And some motives from this novel were taken also from Baku, and I sent this novel to Alexei Parchikov, and he responded with one sentence, and immediately he said, "I read your novel, and I sent you as an answer my poem Oil, which I wrote a week ago. So it happened we sort of had the same subjects. He wrote the poem, I wrote prose. In a way, there was this kind of deep metaphorical expression. In his poem, Alexei, he talks about the metaphysics of oil. And this is also what I remembered and what I used in my novel, The Persian. And also his double verse of Khlebnikov was not written by Khlebnikov, by Alexei Parshikov. So the translator knows that, of course, but the reader does not know it. Well, is it necessary to know that? I don't know. You even brought a photograph. No, no, this is a photograph that I have on my blog as well. Because there is a blog that the translator has. He took all the different photographs and images and characters, and he tried to work on them, always trusting on other people and trusting that everything is true and you will find everything for everything. Truth, that's an epistemological term. And in many things, this book is about things that are true, but that conventional wisdom doesn't think of, and you wouldn't find in encyclopedia. Yes, I can add, since culture also has the culture of writing text, and that is why the text cannot develop, the narrative cannot develop, without changing itself. There is a moment where there's a difference between the direct sense of the words. Then there's the next level of the artistic sense. And this is all about culture and development. And that is why in Talmud you have a sentence that I like. The world is only a story told by someone. And this is a very deep meaning that I believe in. All right, one can say yes, but one may wonder why then, if that is so, why do we need the stories told? Why do we need the biographies? Why do you use history? Why do you use lots of documents in order to leave them at a certain moment in time? We are going to explain that moment when you leave a document again. Couldn't you just narrate and invent? The reality can develop only when it preserves the principle of genuineness. That is to say, if you have the things that you tell the reader, and if this is not genuine, then this whole image is going to crumble. So you need these points of fixation where your ideas are linked to reality. Otherwise, you cannot develop. So, of course, when you develop yourself, you develop the world. That is why you need this link. Maybe we can use one example. You brought a photograph of such a case, an imperial agent, an agent of His Majesty Wilhelm Wasmus. He's somewhere in Azerbaijan. He's an Orientalist. He's, for the first time, I see an image of my own hero. I didn't think I would ever get to see it. This is his incorporation. I can't believe my ears. this is a great success. Of course, the way he looks like, this is all stage. He is an Orientalist, and he has dressed up and looks very Oriental now. He was more Persian than many Persians. And when the Brits in the before the first one, the most Persian thing I see is the pistol, is the weapon. So when the Brits before the war were there, he took a side. Well, a Persian would never come without the holster to put a weapon in. So this Persian appears in the novel, this agent. It's a very important character. And here you need to know that Azerbaijan and Persian are a historical continuum. A lot of Persian history had to be presented in this novel, because these two children, they are brought up by these on the basis of these stories, the stories of Stepan Razin, who went to this region when they could no longer stay in Russia. And for Rasmus, in order to come back to him on the photograph, he dies of a very different death in this novel. And there's a certain law why his death is so different. And so the authenticity nail, that is very important. It is very important to have this kind of fixation to reality. And that is why the images were so important to me, that you could see these historical images. That sharpens your eye, and the reader is invited also to do research, like the translator, in order to see where he leaves this historical level, this level of reality. Let me also add, when a young writer is listening to that, I should have maybe written the novel William the Persian. It's a character that deserves probably a book to be written. This is William Rasmus, William the Persian. What you have invented, well, obviously you looked at biographies. What did he do? He had tried to intervene. But in your novel, he dies. It's a crazy scene. There's a zeppelin flying across the land, the steppe, and he is searching for him. And they find the deceased Rasmus, and they see immediately the photograph and the negative. You see, like a photograph is taken with a bird's eyes view, but that you have invented. Is that correct? You used the image of a nail. Why do you leave the level of reality here? For the novel, it's a very fascinating story, but why do you go away from reality? Does it just happen automatically or intuitively when you are narrating? You know, when I got to know about this person, I was not so sure whether he's real or whether he's a legend, because the texts that I have read about him always were written like legends. In my biography, there is the story of my great-grandfather who lived on the border to Persia. And this grandfather of mine has escaped from Russia through Persia to America and further on. And an Englishman has helped him to cross the border. And in the legend, it says the Englishmen were not so much afraid of the Persians or Russians. the Russian population that was always also present on the border. And they have said the Englishmen are more afraid of the Germans. Why? I don't know. But when I all of a sudden accounted this personage of William, I know why now, why the English were afraid. So what happens, what is really a magic thing with for an author? You have this darkness, semi-darkness, this kind of blindness. And in this blindness, you can see clearer. It's a kind of prophetic instance. So you're in the process of writing, and in the process of translation, a lot of meaning can be created. And so this oblivion and this blindness can create a new meaning, and that can lead to development, as we've talked about, development that is only possible for the world if it has its links to reality, but it does not always stay there. Persia is also important because Hashem had escaped with his parents or his mother. His father was killed before the revolution in Iran, before Ayatollah Khomeini came. And so his renewal has also something to do with getting a distance between himself and the Iran revolution. Mr. Tretner, you had to sort of clear the ground first and find a sense of orientation. And you brought something to symbolize that. I read the novel 2.5 times, and I always encountered something new. I can read it another 2.5 times and still would be able to find new things. But you had to translate, so you had to have a full sense of it. I have created a document. And I've created that document because I felt so completely confused. This novel always has new beginnings and Bermuda triangles, the Bermuda triangles of understanding where you get stuck. And there was a point in time when I didn't know my place anymore. And so I created this document. And since we were still working on the text, because the French had sent us a copy that was not, could not be used. Yeah, we have to explain what that means. Obviously, there were four versions. One version that came out in 2010, then there's a version that came out in 2012, where this novel was published together with three other books. Then the French translation was done. You have shortened that, abridged it. No, it was abridged. The editor did that, and in abridging it, he destroyed the book. And although the French said that the author had given permission for this abridged version, but it was not true, as I found out. And so in a way, the text was so confusingly open, we had to first of all find out that this was a version we could not take. And so all of a sudden, I had this texts, and I started jotting down on paper certain things, and I did it like that in the form of a Leporello. This is the novel. And when I noticed that, I knew that this novel is not a snake, is not a Leporello, but I had to do my Leporello in order to be able to recognize that. For me, this novel in its structure is fascinating, since I can see everything from behind. But as soon as I cross the novel like a reader, I have my blind spots end up in gorges and valleys. And these wonderful images, I had to recognize all of them. And of course, I had to overcome many moments where I found it difficult to go on. And he was sometimes very difficult to translate in this situation. And maybe the author is going to tell us later, maybe that is why it was so clarifying for me when I read in an interview, this novel is a sphere, like a ball. You cannot shorten it because it's so spherical, it's round. And it was good to hear that because the French had really destroyed the novel by abridging it. And after a while, I had this feeling of the novel being an absolutely spherical thing. My impression was different. I thought it was fragmented and full of essays. You hear something about falconry, about oil. Ilya is also looking for the original bacteria from ancient times. Luca, he's looking for Luca. He takes samples from the oil fields and sends them in for analysis. For me, it was a fragmented and very confusing novel. When reading it, I said, okay, now I know how you do it. But let me ask you anyway, how do you do that? How do you keep all these strands together so they don't fall apart? You know, it's a very simple example I can give. Every child, practically every child in the world, has in his or her room the map of the world hanging on the wall of the room. And they always look more or less like the globe. And when you look at the real map on a flat surface, you see these splits as you go closer to the poles. This is the fragmentary nature. The fragments appear only when you try to use this globe, this sphere, and spread it out on a table or hang it out on the wall. So these gaps come open when you have this novel on a very superficial and horizontal level, instead of seeing it all around in its spatial nature. Only when it's not seen multidimensional, you have these fragments and gaps. So probably it's very demanding for the reader, but you do everything for the sake of art. You do everything for art. Well, let me come back to the translator who has a blog on the Surkamp website. And there you show some of your enormous research you've done. You brought photographs that cannot be seen on the blog. You have some of the photographs on the blog and also excerpts from the novel. What helped me a great deal, and I forgot to put it on my blog, were these real photographs from this interesting time, the beginning of the 20th century, from Prakudin Gorsky, a chemist who had invented colored photography for Russia. And in order to make it popular, he developed a major project, namely photographing the whole Russian Empire. A couple of years ago, those photographs were seen in an exhibition in Gropiusbau in Berlin. And they are images. I have these special colors that I needed in order to imagine this world. Here, for instance, you have one of these photographs. It's slightly out of focus. Probably difficult to see the colors, but when you come closer later on, you would see the true colors. It's a tandir, one of those ovens that you use all across Asia in different constructions, building styles, but they are used everywhere by the people living in these regions. And that was an important photograph for me as well. And for Sasha, when we talked about it, when he looked at it, it was a moment of surprise as well. It's a cotton factory right in the middle of this flood landscape, this steppe. There's a lot of grass there. Obviously, there's cotton in the vicinity, so they are irrigating the fields. There you have this classicist architecture next to some futuristic building. And there is a wonderful book about all the photographs and contact prints. It's now in the Library of Congress. And there you can read that this cotton factory was set up by a German immigrant, Hugo Wogau. Right in the middle of nowhere, he built a cotton factory. And next to that factory, we do not know for what reason, we have this pole. And this pole also appears in the novel. One of the best engineers of Russia, who worked for Nobel, Chukhov, built this pole. I have a photograph of Chukhov as well. So he built these poles at a time when they were not known. It was completely new. The Eiffel Tower had just been presented at the Paris World Exhibition. And you've got a similar tower, a similar pole out there in the middle of nowhere. So it is always worthwhile looking for visual evidence of what is happening in the novel in order to keep together these strands and have these links, those nails that pin you close to reality. Chukhov, let me add, Chukhov indeed is a symbol of the totalitarian power that you had present in 1895, when the first oil was produced there in Baku. Oil is a fuel of the 20th century, has helped civilization to develop, but has been one of the reasons why we had so many awful wars. Chukhov was one of the geniuses in engineering. He has created the foundation of architecture. And there are wonderful buildings created today that would not be built without his inventions, the hyperbolic structures. Chukhov has also been involved as an engineer in oil refining, and everyone nowadays still uses things that were invented by Chukhov for oil refineries. It's one of the many characters in the novel that appear just briefly, but for people with an interest in history, they are important. You always are tempted to look for more. You're always tempted, that's a great thing about this novel, to do some more research instead of just saying, I don't know this character, but you want to know more about them. And you do that as a translator as well, and because that means you have to have a lot of time. I thought in the beginning, I'm not now going to get a novel about the periphery of the Soviet Empire, and I'm going to get a novel about the periphery of Azerbaijan, seen from Berlin. And I thought, wonderful, I don't know anything about that. And then I had all these kinds of nails and links to history and reality. Half of the characters maybe are fiction. Yeah, but we also have lots of historical characters. I can tell you how much I tried, and I want to boast about that. I went to a conference on Chlebnikov in Astrakhan. Philologists have discussed a letter that is included in the book, and it was written on behalf of Chlebnikov, and the philologists were looking seriously on these original publications, and they thought, oh my God, this is a new text of Chlebnikov, hitherto not found, as if you hit on a new oil. But this text was written by me, as if Chlebnikov had written it. Without any nail to reality, this was completely invented. What I also would like to do, there is a record. I had a flashback when I was coming here, because 50 years ago, I used to buy records. You never went anywhere without your records. These times are over, but I liked this record. It's one of the many déjà vu effects that a translator has. It's the only Azerbaijani record. It's somewhere in my shelf, and I'd exchanged it 20 or 30 years ago for some other East German records. And the artist here, the musician here, is typical for this link between West and East, because he has taken the old Muriam melodies, a very traditional music, which is orally handed down by generations, and it's hardly ever written as sheet music. He uses that traditional music and combines it with Western music, and he did that very early on in the 60s and 70s. And so many years ago, when I first encountered this record, I had no idea about the tradition, but I liked the music. There's at least one piece which is directly a Mugam song or melody. This is how records looked like in the old days. And he's lots of these things. Superficially, you can say it's folkloristic, but I'm firmly convinced that this music has very deep structural roots. And maybe this also is an analogy to what the novel does here, creating these links. And I also brought another book, also a very fat volume, the Eastern European book on South Caucasus. Completely new book, as nearly as many pages as the novel. And I brought the book because this region is so complex. Eastern Europe is much less in terms of the diversity. And I hope very much that the book will be just as eternal and will resonate through the generations. What I also liked about this novel was the macro level. My feeling was that this Ilya, who had come from California, travels to the East, in many ways goes to spaces that want to be described and are described. And when he comes to Baku and goes to the nature reserve, there is this spatial stagnation. He is there in this park with Hashem. He helps. At least for a year, he spends time there to help. And there, it's all about the depth of time, childhood memories, the history of Baku, this wonderful oil boom, and wealth is explained. And this is kind of dividing line in the book, in the novel. Is this your impression as well? Did you introduce this dividing line on purpose? Honestly, I'm not so sure whether I know the answer to this question. Whether this was done specifically, well, of course, there are many subconscious things and many conscious things as well, many collages and montages. But whether I did that on purpose, this kind of dividing line, this is something I never heard before, never thought of before. So maybe it must have happened quite naturally. But allow me to say a few words about the Mugali songs. I know we have to finish, but let me tell you something very simple. The melodic heart of my childhood is the Mugamba. These songs and I am amazed, and I learned just that Stalker, the soundtrack of Stalker, is based right on these melodies. And Stalker is my favorite film by Tarkovsky. I didn't know he based the music on the Mugamba. So it's very intuitive that this space brings together so many levels. And I was really amazed to see that all of this together also resonates in my book. These are also the things that must have happened naturally. We will have to tell me one more thing. You brought something as well. It's a stone. You were asked, what about the objects? That is very simple. I can do that in 5 words. You know, this stone, on any stone in the world, is a little book. A book written over millions of years. The process of petrification is a long, long story. And when you are in nature and you lift a stone, you must remember this stone maybe has not moved for millions of years. And so this stone here comes from northern Galilee, from the mountains, from the place where many principles that are so important for our modern life were developed. The Kabbalah comes from there. And as far as the link to language is concerned, in the words, the word can change the world. This is also a principle of Chlebnikov's. And in this novel, it is very important to have this link. So, a stone, in a way, is a book for me, especially it's a book written by Chlebnikov, and that is why I brought the stone. Chlebnikov was in the beginning, and Chlebnikov is at the end. So I'd like to thank you for your attention. Thank you.